This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, Peter Mayers here with you in the National Interest on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and online. Today on the program, we'll try to find out what customs officers are being instructed to do if they intercept more Papuans fleeing Indonesia to seek sanctuary in Australia. Also, selling Medicare private, what's left of the Industrial Relations Commission under Work Choices, and the Harley-riding North Queensland Liberal MP and former crocodile catcher who's standing up for the rights of gay couples. Here's some really startling news. According to Sydney's Daily Telegraph, Australians are the second happiest people in the world. This is the conclusion reached by Dr. Andrew Lee, and he's an economist, so it must be true. The only problem is that Dr. Lee can't work out why we're so happy. In fact, he says, we're much happier than we should be, according to our levels of economic performance and growth. And of course, we're only the second happiest people in the world, so who could be jollier than an Australian, you ask? Can't you guess? It's those smiling folk in Iceland, of course. Australian corporate bosses certainly have reason to smile. According to the Financial Review, the average pay of the chief executives of Australia's top 100 listed companies rose to $2.4 million in 2004, an increase of 70% in 3 years. During the same period, the likes of you and me, our wages rose just 15%. South Australia's Liberal Party has uncovered up to 200 bogus members on its books. The Advertiser reports that rorts were discovered before last month's state election, but kept quiet until the vote was over. It seems officials may have become suspicious when 50 new members signed up for the Adelaide Young Liberals on a single day, stretching the credibility of even the most ardent party supporters. Regular donors to the Salvation Army have been somewhat bemused by a letter sent out in recent weeks in which the Sallies backpedal furiously on earlier criticism of the federal government's new welfare-to-work reforms. In February, a fundraising letter urged supporters to dig deep because the Salvation Army was expecting a rush on its services once the welfare-to-work provisions began to bite, and people were pushed off the disability support pension and onto the Newstart allowance. In a second letter, sent out in March, the Salvation Army says that, with the benefit of hindsight, our comments on the welfare-to-work provisions could have been better phrased. 6 dot points of technical bureaucraties follow, which have the definite whiff of a ministerial staffer about them. The Salvation Army admits it did consult the Minister's office to make sure it got the language right in its correction letter. But it says the initiative to correct came from within the organisation itself, and it's not been dictated to by government or told to be quiet. We note in passing that, unlike the Sallies, St Vincent de Paul Society says it will have nought to do with the new welfare-to-work policy, which begins on July the 1st, because it's immoral and unjust. Finally, an update on the upgrade. Regular listeners will recall that last week we reported on the preferential treatment handed out by Qantas to the children of Treasurer Peter Costello. They were removed from cattle class to the comfy seats at the front end of the plane on a flight from LA to Melbourne. Well, we weren't the only ones to pick up on the story. Those busy folk at Crikey.com were also on the case. And interestingly, their story received an immediate response from the Minister's office. Apparently, Mr. Costello had explicitly instructed Qantas not to upgrade his kids before they left, but the airline went ahead and did it anyway. Well, this might excuse the Treasurer. But Crikey's Stephen Mayne argues that Qantas upgrades for Pollies and their families just shouldn't happen. He compares it to Telstra paying every MP's home phone bill, or PBL giving $2,000 worth of gaming chips to every federal politician. Now, I hope Stephen's comments aren't giving corporate relations types some new ideas. Coming up, deciding who comes to our country and the circumstances in which they come. The federal government is talking tough on the prospect of more Papuan asylum seekers attempting to reach Australia by boat. Both Defence Minister Brendan Nelson and the Minister for Customs and Justice, Senator Chris Ellison, have declared that Papuan asylum seekers are no different to any other illegal entrance into Australian territory. A comment that opens up the prospect of boats carrying Papuan asylum seekers being forced back to Indonesia. I spoke to the Customs and Justice Minister, Senator Chris Ellison, on Friday. Senator Ellison, welcome to the National Interest.
Good to be on the show, thank you.
Will boats be pushed back?
Well, it will depend on the circumstances in which we intercept these people, but certainly they will be dealt with as we would deal with any other attempts at illegal entrance into Australia. And, of course, we've put in place measures for dealing with people who try to enter our country illegally, and you've seen what we've done in the past, and our policy has not changed.
You said that Papuan asylum seekers are no different to any other boat people, but that's not the case, is it? I mean, these are Indonesian nationals fleeing directly from Indonesia. They're not like Afghans or Iraqis who are coming through another country.
Well, of course, when we dealt with the people smuggling issues before, we didn't know where those people came from at the time. Subsequently, of course, we verified that. But when we come upon a boatload of people who are trying to enter Australia illegally, we don't have the benefit of knowing their background, what their case is or why they're there. All we are presented with is an attempt to enter Australia illegally. Now, of course, we have measures for dealing with that, and, of course, our policy is also very well known, and we will maintain that policy.
You accept that forcing a refugee back to a place of persecution is a breach of international law?
Look, I think that the international law that we're upholding is our sovereignty, in that we're maintaining our borders. As the Minister for Customs and Justice, I have responsibility for border control, and that is to safeguard our borders against illegal fishing, illegal entrance, security risks, and anything else which might pose a risk to this country, including quarantine. Now, that is a right we have to maintain, and that is our sovereignty as a nation and our sovereign waters.
Australia is a signatory to the International Convention on Refugees. Do you accept that forcing a refugee back to a place of persecution breaches that convention and is a breach of international law?
When we're faced with a boatload of people, they don't come with a sign saying these are refugees. When we're presented with that situation on the water, we don't know who they are, we don't know their background. They might say they're refugees, they might say they're all sorts of things, but I have to tell you that we're primarily charged with looking out for Australia's sovereignty and security, and that means that we intercept people who are trying to enter this country illegally, and that could involve a number of measures which would be determined at the time by authorities who are engaging in the process of looking after our borders. But I stress that Australia has an obligation with refugees, and we've maintained that obligation. In fact, we have a very generous refugee program.
Yes, but we're talking here about people coming directly from another country to Australia. We're not talking about resettling refugees, which is quite separate to the Refugee Convention. The question is here, what instructions will you give to customs officers if they intercept a boat to ascertain whether or not those people may have a claim to protection as refugees?
Well, there is a process for determining that, and that is under the immigration legislation. Customs officers are not the people who determine who is a refugee and who isn't.
No, but they determine whether someone gets an opportunity to make a claim or not. They police the border.
Can I tell you that when you're on the open water and you're presented with a situation of this sort, there are all sorts of considerations which have to be taken into account. And, of course, maintaining the integrity of our borders is a primary function of customs, navy, and those who patrol our borders. Another one, of course, is to preserve life at sea. If there is an aspect of danger to life, if there is any issue with seaworthiness of the vessel, there are other considerations. You also have to look at the demeanour of the people concerned. Is there a security risk to the crew if we take them on board? Are they being aggressive? All those sorts of considerations have to be made, and we rely on the judgment of our people out there when these encounters occur. Now, for me to say, look, I will dictate as to what happens in any given situation, we rely on our professional people out there to make a decision.
But surely you give them policy instructions. I mean, we know, for example, in the US case, if the United States intercepts boat people from Haiti, those boat people have to really pass what's called the shout test. That is, they have to make it clear to the US Coast Guard that they are refugees. They have to signal clearly that they're seeking protection, otherwise they'll be returned. Will Papuans have to pass the shout test with Australian customs officials, or will customs officials ask them, do you have a fear of going back to Indonesia?
Look, when we encounter vessels which are trying to enter Australia illegally, we certainly say to them, we are Australian Customs or Navy, and you are entering Australian waters illegally. And in the past, the process has been to advise them to turn back. In some cases, there has been, depending on the circumstances, an engagement with the people concerned. But it is not for the our people on the water to determine whether these people are refugees or their background. The first thing we have to establish is any presence of threat that may be presented by these people. We do not know who they are, and of course that is very difficult to determine when you're out in the water. We will maintain our policy of protecting Australia's borders and the right to determine who can come to this country under what circumstances.
Do customs officers have an obligation to uphold international law and Australian law in upholding the Refugee Convention?
Australian customs officers have an obligation to uphold Australian law, and that is across the board. And that is something which they've been carrying out very professionally over a long period of time. Navy isn't precisely the same boat. We have a law in Australia which we abide by, and that's exactly what they do.
But now, the fundamental point is this: will they attempt to ascertain whether the people have a real fear of going back to Indonesia? Because if they don't, and if they push boats back to Indonesia, they will be potentially in breach of the Refugee Convention, in breach of international law.
That's not the job of a customs officer, with great respect.
But a customs officer determines whether or not someone will go through the appropriate process. I mean, they are at the threshold. They make a decision at the threshold.
If someone was to say, we are refugees, and the customs officer takes them at face value, I mean, that explanation could be offered by anybody.
Yes, but
including terrorists. I mean,
yes, but I mean, then they go into detention. Then you assess their claims. I mean, those are not the key issues. The key issue is whether or not people are forced back, who are refugees, forced back to a situation of persecution.
And depending on the circumstances, there may well be in the interdiction an apprehension of people. That may well occur. Turning back of vessels. I'm not going to say that in any particular circumstance what will occur. What I am saying is that we will police our borders, as we have always done, and we have made it abundantly clear that border security is a priority of this government. It is part of the law of this country, after all. I mean, quite frankly, if there's a quarantine risk, that could be a breach of the law. If there is a security
but,
risk...
But Senator Ellison, if I can interrupt, I mean, quarantine, security breaches, this is the whole reason we have a detention policy for people who enter the country illegally seeking asylum. I mean, those issues are dealt with through the detention policy. People presumably would be taken to Christmas Island. You're proposing is turning boats back to Indonesia when they are carrying people who potentially, who say they are, fleeing persecution in Indonesia.
I have said that we have in the past said to vessels that are trying to enter Australia illegally that they should turn back. We've also in the past apprehended people and taken them to places like Christmas Island. It depends on the circumstances. And all I'm saying is that from my point of view, I am concerned with the protection protection of the border of this country.
But you won't tell us what will guide customs officers when they encounter a boat on the water. What will guide them to determine whether to force people back or whether to...
What I've just outlined to you in detail the sorts of things that are taken into account when you encounter a vessel with people on board at sea who are trying to enter Australia illegally. There are a number of considerations that are taken into account. Now, I'm not going to go into great operational detail other than to say that the person in charge, the skipper of the customs vessel or the captain of the naval vessel, makes a decision as to how to deal with things at the time. And we've seen some very difficult occasions in the past where Navy and Customs have done a fantastic job, but they have to assess the situation on the water. It's all very well for us to be sitting as armchair critics.
Well, I'm not suggesting we're sitting as armchair critics. I'm suggesting that there should be a clear set of policies by which naval officers or customs officers know what's expected of them if people present as refugees.
I can tell you what the first thing is, and that is the preservation of life.
Sure, I accept that.
I accept that.
Let's deal with the specific case where people say, we are refugees. What happens then? Do they get sent back or do they get an opportunity to have their claim tested?
It may well be that they are apprehended and taken into a detention centre. Christmas Island has been an example, or another centre, depending on what immigration determines. But if someone is attempting to enter Australia illegally, we do make a request that they turn back, and we've done that before.
But my question is, if they say, look, we are refugees, we are fleeing persecution, will they under any circumstances be forced back to Indonesia?
Well, it may well be that if there is, depending on the circumstances of the case, and you have to remember that, and I'm not going to talk about hypotheticals here, but you have to look at the risk to human life. You have to look at the behaviour of the people concerned. If there is a risk, if someone comes to you brandishing a weapon,
I'm talking about a situation where people say, no, please help us, we're refugees.
You have to understand.
And whether or not that boat would be sent back. It's a quite clear question, Senator. It's quite clear cut.
No, it isn't. It's not clear at all, because what you're not acknowledging are the varying circumstances you can encounter on the high seas and out there in the water where our people are doing a very difficult job. And I'm not going to be tying down in any shape or form the discretion of our commanding officers to make a decision which is in the best interest of their crew and the preservation of life at sea. Now, it might all very well be for armchair critics to sit back and do that. But I challenge them to be on the water at the time, to make the decision when they meet people who say, without verification of identity or where they've come from, what their intentions are, and our authorities are charged with the protection of our borders. It is a decision we make on a case-by-case basis, dependent on circumstances. That is how we've operated in the past. Our policy is very clear.
Senator Ellison, thank you for your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Senator Chris Ellison, the Minister for Justice and Customs. Coming up, selling Medibank private. After 3 years of toying with the idea, the federal government has confirmed that it will sell Medibank private, the country's largest health insurer. Finance Minister Nick Minchin can see no good reason for the health fund to stay in public hands. Critics can see no good reason to sell it. Health economist Professor John Deeble was the architect of the original Medibank, the universal healthcare system introduced under Gough Whitlam. And in 1976, he helped to convince Malcolm Fraser to set up Medibank Private as a government-owned insurer. John Deeble, what was the original rationale for Medibank Private?
Hello, Peter. Well, Medibank Private was set up as a guarantee, mainly actually to the trade unions, led then by Bob Hawke, that if people were not going to have access to the then Medibank, they could join a government fund. They were not to be forced to join a private health fund. Now, that's the circumstances. But also, it was seen as a way of guaranteeing, through a government authority, health insurance without frills, but with at the minimum cost and in the interests of the contributors.
So, in a sense, it was to keep competition in the market with private sector insurers.
Yes, and it was a set of standard that would be the standard to which the private insurers would have to adhere.
And are those things still relevant in your view?
Absolutely. I can see no public interest in selling Medibank private. There's no government money in it. The government provided in 1976, I think, $11 million so that it could start up with some reserves, so that it was sound from the start. And that was repaid in the early 1980s. And I was a director of Medibank Private for 17 years while it was run by the Health Insurance Commission. During that time, we operated to provide insurance at the lowest rate that was possible. We paid no dividends to the government. We held reserves that were financed by the members' contributions, but we did not attempt to make a profit beyond the maintenance of satisfactory reserves.
But didn't all that change in 1998? I mean, Medibank Private then was separated from the Health Insurance Commission. It became an independent, wholly government-owned company, a government business enterprise. And as we know, under the Howard government, government business enterprises are expected to behave just like a private business. I mean, well, how is it now different from any other medical fund?
I'm not privy since, well, I left the Health Insurance Commission in 99. I don't know how Medibank Private has behaved since. I'm not privy to those details. But it was still true that having a government-owned health insurance fund did several things. First of all, it guaranteed that a standard was available and that standard would not be overpriced. And secondly, something that seemed very important to me, but may not be important to the government, is emphasised that private insurance was a part of the Medicare system. It wasn't outside it. It wasn't a competitor with Medicare, it was part of the system. Now, there's this temptation to say Medicare is the public hospitals and it's nothing to do with private insurance, but in fact it is. Or it has got something to do with private insurance as well. For all of those reasons, I think that the retention of Medibank Private is in the public interest and the sale is not.
Well, Medibank Private holds hundreds of millions of dollars in cash reserves, obviously as it needs to do in order to cover any future payouts. Who does that money belong to?
Well, the government has a legal right. The only two shares in Medibank Private are owned by, I think, the Minister for Finance and the Treasurer, but I'm not certain about who is the nominal holder.
But essentially the government owns the company.
Essentially the government owns the company and there are no other shareholders. That's because it was never set up as a mutual fund like, say, NRMA was, where there was a legal title to the reserves but by the previous members. But there is a moral entitlement. Those reserves have been built up by the members of Medibank Private, the customers. They weren't the customers so much as the members. And that the government is now proposing to sell those reserves and take it. In effect, it's taking out the reserves that are there for itself, and some buyer is going to have to put them back. Or alternatively, you can see it as selling the reserves. But either way, it wasn't government money in the first place.
So if they are going to sell Medibank Private, as the government has said it will, should policyholders get something from the sale? Should they get shares in the new private company? Or should they get some kind of payout in recognition of the contributions they've made?
I think in practice it's almost impossible to do that because a number of people who contributed to those reserves are maybe not even alive now. You can't distribute reserves according, or can't easily do it, according to length of membership. So in practice, it would be very difficult to do an NRMA type sale. I mean, it's not easy to see how any of the sale options will really work equitably for everyone.
Well, there are some key questions about the nature of the privatisation too, and one option under discussion is a trade sale, which would mean presumably an existing private insurer would snap up Medicare Private, which has about 30%, I think, of all policyholders in Australia. Now, wouldn't that lessen competition in the market for private health insurance?
Well, it's certainly the one that would probably maximise the price, because what the government really would be selling, I mean, selling the reserves is not really all that relevant. They're worth what they are worth. There's no profits or gains to be made from those. You are selling the Medibank private name, and that private name carries a number of people with it, and it carries it's worth something commercially, and it's worth more probably to another health fund than it is to anybody else. The difficulty with that is that Medibank private is the dominant insurer. It's 30%, but in places like Western Australia, Northern Territory, and I think to a lesser extent South Australia, if the resident fund were to buy Medibank private, well, there were really only two dominant funds in those places.
So if Medibank private was bought up, there'd only be one?
There'd only be one. And that would create a
monopoly.
A monopoly, yes, absolutely. Now, you could imagine a New South Wales fund buying a share of Medibank private, or buying Medibank private in Western Australia, if it was broken up like that, because it might give them an entry into Western Australia without it being the dominant fund. So there are all sorts of permutations, but you would have to look at every case, and I can't see that it could be done easily nationally. It could be done on a state-by-state basis, which means not selling Medibank private, but selling all its little bits.
Well, another alternative is an overseas buyer, an insurance company or someone from overseas coming in. Is that a possibility, do you think, or is the medical insurance market in Australia simply not attractive enough in profit terms?
I think the latter. You see, most of the health funds, in major health funds in Australia, besides Medibank private, are not for profit. That's it's not unique. There are some small profit-making funds, but most of them are not for profit. Now, if Medibank private was to be sold to a big insurance company, then in fact they will want a return. If they pay $1 billion, which I don't think the government will get $1 billion, by the way, but if they were paid $1 billion. They would want a commercial return on that. And that means they'd want to get about 15% and minimum a return on their capital. That's $150 million a year. Now, that's going to the owners. Medibank Private made a profit of that sort of order, or a surplus of that sort of order, last year, but that money went to the reserves. And it wouldn't need to make a profit of $150 million every year, because that would mean the reserves would grow enormously. And in all the time that I was there, if we made a profit one year that would push their reserves up beyond a reasonable level, we didn't charge as much the next year. But a commercial buyer would want it all the time.
Okay.
And that seems to be the problem. Now, there is one thing the government can do, and evidently is thinking about doing, is widening the market for health insurance by allowing the health funds to go into out-of-hospital insurance, which is now the purview of Medicare. And if they did that, then they would probably widen the market and it might be more attractive, but they would have to do it by compromising with the universality arrangements of Medicare.
Professor Deeble, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Health economist Professor John Deeble, one of the architects of Australia's universal healthcare system and a former board member of Medibank Private. Coming up, the President of the Australian Industrial Relations Commission. At the time of Federation, the Australian Industrial Relations Commission, or its predecessor, was established as one of the three legs of what became known as the Australian Settlement. Together with the White Australia policy and tariff protection for local businesses, the Commission's arbitration in strikes and pay disputes was meant to guarantee industrial peace and ensure that workers received a fair share of the nation's prosperity. Well, White Australia is long gone, tariffs have all but disappeared, and many would say the 102-year-old Industrial Relations Commission is a shadow of its former self. Under Work Choices, the federal government's new IR regime, the Commission has lost some of its key powers, such as setting the minimum wage and certifying industrial agreements. Justice Jeffrey Judicher was appointed president of the Industrial Relations Commission in 1997 by former Workplace Relations Minister Peter Reith. Justice Judicher, welcome to the National Interest.
Hi, Peter.
Has the Industrial Relations Commission been gutted, as some media commentators are saying?
I don't think that's an accurate description. If you look at the various powers the Commission exercises, I think it becomes clear that while there's been a pretty significant change, obviously, in the Commission's role, the Commission is still well and truly alive. If I could look firstly at the one you've mentioned, which is the fixation of minimum wages, just in terms of the effort expended on that activity each year, it involves seven members of the Commission on and off for a period of a couple of months. There are more than 40 members of the Commission nationwide, so as a proportion of the Commission's work, it's actually quite small, although, of course, it's an extremely important function.
And a very public one, and one that people watch with great interest.
Well, that's right. People see members of the Commission bowing and on the evening news and so on, and so it gives the Commission a high profile. But, in fact, the core business of the Commission is resolving industrial disputes, and it always has been. And that function will continue, and in fact, in some respects, will be broader because, as you would be aware, the new system is based on the corporation's power and purports to be a national system, so that many of the disputes that might have been dealt with by state industrial relations commissions in Queensland, New South Wales, Western Australia and so on will now come to our commission where they involve corporations. That's an important change in our jurisdiction, and of course it's unclear at this stage exactly what it will mean in terms of the volume of cases.
But they don't have to come to you, do they? I mean, the Commission can have a role in resolving disputes, but only if both parties agree to go before the Commission.
That's so, and that's a significant change in one respect because it's something which has not been in the legislation before, but in fact it's not such a significant change in practice because... If you go back to the early 90s, when the then Labor government introduced a system of enterprise bargaining, the Commission's arbitral role, in fact, reduced very dramatically at that time and was confined to setting what was known as the award safety net. Enterprise bargaining was primarily a matter for the parties, and we as members of the Commission didn't impose settlements in enterprise bargaining disputes except in very limited circumstances where the national interest may have been affected. So in some ways, the current legislation really recognises the decline in compulsory arbitration, which started in 93 and was extended in 96 with the Workplace Relations Act.
But you're now also sort of in competition with private sector arbitrators and dispute resolution businesses, aren't you?
We are. And
So will people come to the Commission or will they go to the private sector? Well, does it depend on price or what?
I don't know exactly what it will depend on, but all I can say is that from the Commission's point of view, we do have a considerable amount of expertise in this area, accumulated knowledge of 100 years. We have some very talented people in the Commission.
Sounds like an advertising pitch.
Well, you asked me. And so I think that we are able to make a real contribution in this area. The resolution of industrial disputes is never easy. It looks easy, and of course, many commentators are always ready with the solution. But in fact, it's quite difficult to reconcile the sometimes very deeply felt emotions on both sides, and also the legitimate commercial and personal interests that come into conflict. So and it's hard work, and I think that the Commission will continue to make its contribution.
And the Commission can't force a resolution on the parties, can it? It can't say this is what you have to do and this is what you have to do.
No, it can't, although there are obviously circumstances in which the parties agree at the outset or through some dispute resolution procedure they adopt for general use that they will accept Commission decisions, and that sort of system operates... or did operate before Work Choices and will continue to operate.
Let's turn to the area of unfair dismissal. If a company employs less than 100 workers, then the Commission no longer has a role in unfair dismissal cases. So
yes.
What do I do if I think I've been unfairly dismissed and I work for a company with less than 100 employees?
Well, you probably go and seek some advice from somebody. Generally speaking, the Commission doesn't give advice on matters of that kind, but there are remedies at common law in the civil courts.
In other words, I take a suit in the Federal Magistrates Court or something like that.
Yes.
Engage a lawyer.
Or possibly in a state jurisdiction. But there may be remedies if the dismissal is unlawful, that is based on a discriminatory reason or something like that. But really, you need to take some advice.
Because, I mean, some observers are saying this is going to be a lawyer's picnic and, you know, that it's going to force a lot more work onto courts like the Federal Magistrates Court.
Look, I'd prefer not to speculate about that. It may be the case, Peter, that will occur. Experience would suggest that there'll continue to be disputes and that some forum will have to be found to deal with them. But I guess we'll see how that works out.
Well, look, the Industrial Relations Commission is required to act quickly and in a way that avoids unnecessary technicalities and legalities. But it's also now hemmed in by rules and regulations. And if we take the example of strikes, if my colleagues and I want to go on strike here at the ABC, you now have to organise a secret ballot on our behalf. And I gather that's going to take you at least 10 days or perhaps longer.
Yes, well, there was a decision on that issue, I think yesterday, by one of our members. But in general, what you say is correct. If an attendance ballot can't be arranged, then it's necessary for there to be a secret ballot. That's a postal ballot. And there's a necessity to settle the roll of voters and to allow sufficient time for the ballot papers to be sent out by mail, to be responded to, and for the result to be declared. We would hope that we can get that back shorter than 10 days, but it looks at the moment as though that might be about the time it's going to take.
It's a pretty big ask. I mean, it's quite a complicated thing to do, isn't it? You've got to check whether people are still at the same address and whether they've received the ballot paper and all sorts of things.
I think there are issues like that which will have to be dealt with, but I'm not sure that this can't be something which people get used to in time. It just involves perhaps some planning and some more forethought before industrial action's taken.
Well, some commentators have been suggesting that the overall impact of work choices and the decline of the role of the Commission in its arbitration and conciliation functions could lead to an increase in what are called wildcat strikes in the US, that is, people simply taking industrial action of different kinds, even sabotage or undeclared go-slows or, you know, not following directives and so on.
Well, look, I think that really is speculation. We have in this country, generally speaking, I think, certainly in the last decade or 15 years, a fairly high respect for the law and industrial relations, and we haven't really seen a great deal of that kind of behaviour, which perhaps we did see in earlier times, the 70s and 80s. I'd be hopeful that would not occur, but that if problems arise in relation to the implementation of these new procedures, that the government would in due course look at them sensibly and make what changes are necessary.
I mean, the respect for industrial relations law was partly based probably on the fact that there was seen to be an independent arbiter. There was seen to be this independent commission, the Industrial Relations Commission, which could act as an honest broker in disputes.
Well, we're still there, of course, Peter, and we're still going to perform that function, as I've indicated, and I think we'll perform it very effectively in the interest of the parties and in the interests of the public generally. But these things are evolutionary. I think that the kind of system we had until the early 90s, for example, was one which was really related to some different economic conditions and different social institutions. At about that time, we had deregulation of the banking sector and deregulation of other markets. The dollar was floated and so on. And I think that the change in our industrial laws really has reflected that general deregulation.
Mm. The work choices legislation, of course, might yet fall over. I mean, it's going to be challenged, isn't it, constitutionally in the High Court?
It is, and that, of course, introduces an element of uncertainty for everybody, whether the legislation will be either in whole or in part disallowed by the High Court, of course, will have an impact on the way in which people have conducted their business in the meantime. From our point of view, really, we are assuming it's valid. We'll have to do that, and I think most other people will have to as well, and we'll just take what comes.
At a conference of the Australian Mines and Metals Association recently, you said that work choices would slow the rate of growth of minimum wages under the Fair Pay Commission and may require a cut in social welfare so that there'd still be an incentive for people to go to work rather than stay on welfare.
Yes, well, I think that those comments have perhaps not in accordance with my intention been taken up by various actors in the political debate, and I certainly had not intended by them to identify myself with one side or the other in that political debate. But what I was really referring to is that there is now a change in the criteria which will be applied in the fixation of minimum wages. The Fair Pay Commission will look at criteria which are more related to the market and the market for employment.
The price of employing new workers.
Yes. Whereas the criteria that the Commission had to look at concerned two things which are no longer in the legislation. One was the needs of the low paid as a specific obligation. And the second was that the safety net should be set having regard to living standards generally prevailing, which meant that you had to look to general living standards in setting the wages for the people at the bottom of the labour market. So that's the first thing, which suggests that there may be different outcomes from the Fair Pay Commission deliberations than there were from the Commission's, simply on the basis the criteria are different. The second issue, which I was drawing attention to, was that there is obviously a relationship in terms of employment between minimum wages and the level of social welfare, and that if one ignores that relationship, one does so at one's peril.
Because people may decide it's better to stay on welfare than to go out and get a job.
Well, that's so, yes. Mm. But precisely how those things are worked out are obviously matters for the Fair Pay Commission, and they're difficult questions. I can give my personal experience as a testament to that, and I certainly wish them all the best in what is a very difficult and politically controversial task of fixing minimum wages.
Justice Judicia, thank you very much for joining me on The National Interest.
It's my pleasure.
Justice Geoffrey Judicia, who's President of the Australian Industrial Relations Commission. Coming up, North Queensland Liberal MP Warren Ench, the unlikely champion of gay rights. ACT Chief Minister John Stanhope is at loggerheads with the federal government over his plans to bring in same-sex civil union laws. The Prime Minister and the Federal Attorney General have attacked the proposal, saying it undermines the sanctity of marriage as a union between a man and a woman. But John Stanhope has won support from an unlikely quarter. Liberal backbencher and former Parliamentary Secretary Warren Ench is the MP for Leichhardt, which takes in far north Queensland. Before entering Parliament in 1996, Mr. Ench was variously a grazier, crocodile farmer, real estate agent, fitter and welder, and an aircraft mechanic in the RAAF. And his favourite pastime is riding a Harley-Davidson. Warren Ench, how's the motorbike?
Spends too much time in the shed, unfortunately. But
Do you have it with you in Canberra, or you only get to ride it when you go back to Cairns?
Only when I go back to Cairns, and only very occasionally at this point, but I'm determined it'll stay there until I have more time to enjoy it.
Why have you taken up the issue of discrimination against gays and lesbians in same-sex relationships?
Well, I'd always very much of the view that that we are not discriminating on the basis of gender or race or for any reason. And it came to my attention a couple of, probably about 18 months or so, 2 years ago, when I had a Navy chap come in and see me in my office and expressing concerns that he'd been posted away from Cairns. And he had, the Navy had offered to shift all of his personal effects, which included his budgerigar and his dog, but had drawn the line at shifting his partner on the basis that his partner was same-sex. And I was quite appalled with that. I mean, they'd been in a relationship, I understand, for something like about 15 years or more. And for the love of me, I couldn't understand why such a thing would occur.
Were you able to fix that particular situation?
Well, it has. Yes, we have now. In fact, you know, there has been some movements in recent time. I mean, and the more I dig into it, the more appalled I was at the discriminatory practices there. And I mean, there's hardly any legislation that we have in the federal parliament that does not discriminate.
Give us some examples then of what concerns
you. Well, I mean, it's most of the legislation that we have going through at the moment is gender-specific, whether it be Centrelink legislation, Veterans Affairs legislation, whether it be superannuation, and we have scratched the surface, and I mean that literally, just scratched the surface on superannuation, whether it be even more recently legislation that we put on through on industrial relations. It is immigration. It's gender specific, and you know, my argument is that it should be gender neutral. I think we should be looking at introducing a interdependency provision in there, and so that people that are interdependent on each other, because you know there are people that are interdependent that are not in a sexual relationship.
It might be brothers and sisters, or, for example,
a whole range of them there that really fit that description. And quite frankly, I don't believe that we should be allowing that discrimination to continue. And so for those reasons, and then it really came to the surface with the marriage legislation last year.
I think it was 2004, in fact, just before
2004.
The last federal election, yeah.
And that's right, it was too. And I expressed concern at the time to the Prime Minister and in the party room that I felt uncomfortable in the way we were going. And because I, like probably most people, have quite a number of gay friends, that and some of those friends have been in relationships for 20, 25 years. In fact, a lot more successful in relationships than what I have. And I accept them at home, in their homes. I get invited to their homes and I go there and I accept them as a couple. I invite them to my home and I accept them as a couple. And I just didn't feel comfortable about then coming down to Canberra and adopting a different position. And as I argued more recently, it seems to me that those that argue against or argue that we shouldn't be affording the same legal recognition, if you like, tend to base their arguments more focusing on the sex in the relationship rather than the relationship itself. And that's the reason why I focus on the interdependency argument. Because, I mean, as I said before, I mean, after a period of time, whether it be 5 or 10 or 15 years or whatever, you know, sex does tend to take a back seat to all of the other emotions and other that come with a long-term relationship. And if you could put yourself in the shoes of an individual or a couple of individuals that, for example, and I think this is a good example, where two people have been together in a same-sex relationship. They might have been together for 20 or 30. I've got instances of 40 years I'm aware of. And their family, if you like, had disowned them because of their sexuality and because of the relationship and had nothing to do with them for all these years. And then one of those individuals died.
And everything goes to the family and not to the partner.
Well, the family then can step in and take control. And to me, I think that is absolutely appalling. And, you know, so I argue that we should be recognizing these commitments, this interdependency, these relationships in a way to afford them at least the respect of being able to have some say in their affairs. You know, the other thing that worries me, and I tie this into the mental health issue, which is very much an issue that I have been very much driving for the last 2 years, because they're intermingled. And, you know, unfortunately, the cemeteries are full of individuals that have not been able to cope with the discrimination that has been because of the trying to deal with their sexuality, and have eventually suicided for it, or had a life of misery. And I think we've got to stop doing that. And by government allowing the discrimination to continue in the laws that we make in this country, all we're doing is contributing to the ongoing misery and, quite frankly, contributing to that growing death toll. And I will not be part of it. And well, that's the reason why I'm determined to continue to pursue this.
Have you received, or what kind of response have you received to your advocacy of this cause in your own party and in your electorate of Leichhardt and Far North Queensland?
Interestingly enough, I often make the comment that I'm probably the most unlikely advocate in this area because of my background and because of my demographics, I suppose. I don't know why that should make a difference, but it tends to with the correspondence that I get. But what I have found is that overwhelming amount of people that have contacted me since I've been speaking out on this and congratulating me for it have been people that are not gay themselves, but have family or friends that are gay, and they're saying, at last we've got somebody that is not seen as a gay activist, if you like, that is speaking out, because we're not gay, but we think it's unfair the way in which our family members or whatever or friends are being treated, and good on you, and we're prepared to now come out and say we're very supportive of the rights for the gay community as well. And that's given me that encouragement to do that. I mean, I've also had a lot of support from within the gay community, as you would expect. Interestingly enough, the opposition that I've had to taking this position has been almost insignificant. I've probably had less than a dozen communiques, and that's in literally thousands, and without exception, and this is an interesting point, and one that's sort of formulating my own thinking, without exception, every one of those objectors is focused on the sex, if you like. And so I'm arguing, let's take the sex out of this debate, let's focus on equity, let's focus on interdependency. And talking to representatives within the gay community, that's exactly what they're wanting to achieve as well.
Warren Ench, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure, absolute pleasure. All I can say is that, from a government perspective, we keep saying that we are that we are non-discriminatory. I'm saying if we're going to talk the talk, it's about time we started to walk the walk as well.
Warren Ench is the Federal Liberal MP representing Leichhardt in Far North Queensland. That's it for The National Interest. The program is produced by Verica Jokic. Technical production this week by Alec McCloskey. I'm Peter Mayers. Thanks for your company. I hope you can join me again at the same time next week on ABC Radio National in The National Interest.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.